Succession number 26560, Reel 4.
Mr. Nicol, Reel 4. We're talking about when you went on embarkation leave, just before you went off to Korea.
We got to, it's either Victoria or London Bridge, I just forget, and we got to cross over to Liverpool Street to get a train to Norwich. And as we walked out the station, RSM Gilchrist stood next to a taxi. He had seen us, and we didn't know, and he beckoned us over to his taxi, and we rode across London in his taxi at his expense. And from then on, he was the number one guy, you know. It was just an act like that, you know. Still dead scared of him, but he was a good man, yeah. And anyone that really knew Gilly, as we called him, had a lot of respect for him. I think he was an ex-Irish guardsman, actually. Yeah.
And what about Tim Chatting? What about
Tim? Tim used to make a lot of noise, but his bark was worse than his bite, and he was a thoroughly good all-round chap, actually. He was a good company sergeant major.
Did you have much to do with him? I mean...
not only if we did anything wrong, he did, you know... if things were all right, he kept out of his way, but, yeah, he was all right.
Now, when you first joined him, what was your accommodation like? We'll just run through a couple of things like this.
Where?
Yeah, were you
being
at Dover, I mean?
Oh, at Dover? Oh, big old barrack rooms, really the same as they were at Colchester. But we weren't there many weeks. And then we went to Crowborough. The accommodation was a little bit better, but they were barracks, you know, and we didn't sort of really expect too much. The facilities, shower and bathing facilities, were probably the best that we'd had. The food was better because we were now with the battalion. I think the standards were higher. You know, we weren't in a training camp. Crowborough was a very sort of pleasant stay, if you like. But
did you make any sort of friends amongst the lads, or particular friends that stayed with you?
Yeah, I suppose I had several friends. I didn't sort of just have one friend. I was friendly with quite a lot of guys, and depending on where they were going and when, I'd go out with them or with some of the others, you know. In sort of, I didn't have anything sort of anyone special, not at that stage.
But generally, you all got on well?
Yes, I think so.
Was there any differentiation between regular, I mean, it was a regular battalion, regulars and national service, or was it mostly national?
There were a few regulars, but we outnumbered them, you know, sort of 10-1, I would think, you know. Most of the regulars that had been in the battalion had come over from Germany, and some of them went to Korea, but most of them were also due for release. So we didn't really have many regulars. I mean, obviously the sergeants were, and the sergeant majors, they were all regulars, and most of the officers above lieutenant were regulars, but. There were a few old soldiers, but not that many. The feeling towards them, we usually gave them a wide berth, to be honest.
Why?
Well, we always thought that they knew more than us, and they'd never got on, you know. They weren't NCOs, so they couldn't have been really a lot good, you know. We steered clear, really. Yeah.
There anything else about, you know, in England before you left?
No, I don't think so, really. We sort of apart from the day-to-day stuff, you know.
Did you get into trouble at all? Or
I got into trouble at Bury St Edmunds.
What had happened?
Well, we got a barrack bomb, we got no fuel. Another chap and I, there was some gardens backing onto the camp, and there were lots of wooden crates piled up against the fence, and we said, well, we'll take some of these, which we did, broke them up, and we were warm. The trouble was, the crates were bound with wire and staples, and they searched the... obviously the owner complained, naturally enough, and they searched around and looked in the fire and in the old tortoise stove, and ours was the only one with sort of wire and staples in. So we were called out on parade, and they said, you know, who did it? And nobody owned up. And then they said, well, you're all going to be confined to camp this weekend until you do. So he and I, we sort of owned up to it, and got a weekend fatigue job in the cookhouse. We couldn't go home, you know. So that was our punishment. That was the only time I ever got into trouble, really.
Now, what was cookhouse fatigues like?
It was lovely, because we could have all we liked to eat, you know. washing up, mainly, and over the weekend, the camp was fairly quiet, because most of the people had gone for the weekend, you know. We weren't supposed to go out. We were put under the charge of a catering corps corporal who took us out on the Saturday and Sunday night. So we didn't really suffer. That was an easy one, really.
Now, what about the preparations for going away? Any preparations you recall?
Training, and that was really about it.
Did you get any different uniforms in England?
Yes, I think we were issued with the Korean kit before we left.
Do you remember what it was?
It was sort of dark green, not webbing exactly, but sort of canvassy equipment, pouches, packs. I think we got our winter clothing, which consisted of sort of long john underpants and vests and trousers and parkas with hoods. A couple of pairs of gloves, special boots. We sort of got rid of the ammunition boot and got a Korean boot, which had a thick treaded rubber sole.
Now, were you told at all about what was going on? Were you aware of what was going on in Korea at all?
We were briefed by the battalion. The sort of thing that was given to us. The battalion's been honoured and we're being sent to Korea, sort of thing. You know, that was the first we knew about it. I suppose if anyone had been long-sighted enough, we'd have realised that they were bringing the battalion up to strength from recruits like myself from the north, Northamptonshire, Beds and Hearts and Essex. They were all sort of shoved over to the Norfolk. I suppose we should have seen what was coming, but we didn't really know until we were told that we were going to Korea, and this was at Crowborough.
And were you briefed at all about sort of the political situation? What was happening in Korea?
Not at that stage, no. That came a bit later on. We were then given sort of talks about if we were taken prisoner and what we should try and do to make contact with people back home and this sort of thing. But no, we weren't given any information, not in England.
Now, so you had embarkation leave?
Yep. Which was, I think, 28 days. And then we reported back to Crowborough, I suppose. And then from there we caught the boat.
Do you remember the name of the boat?
Empire Orwell. Yeah.
And
that would be in... I was 19 in the August... And you couldn't go unless you were 19, so I just scraped through.
They left in September, did they? Or?
That was September, yeah. The boat journey, I think, took us 6 weeks. And in all that 6 weeks, we did nothing but training.
Now, what were conditions like on the boat? I mean, you know...
Well, pretty crowded, but very food was very good, and the boat was very clean. Well, we had to keep it clean.
What was your mess deck like?
Well, we had sort of swing-down bunks, if you like. They hinged and either went up or down. And your bedding. Not much room for your kit, I remember. But adequate. Because we really only slept down there and got yourself ready, and then you were either training or your leisure time was spent up on deck or in the place playing cards.
And there was enough food or...
Well, never enough food, but you survived on it, and it was good food on the boat. It was good food. It was a good boat, the Emperor Orwell.
Now, what about the training? What kind of training were you doing?
Machine gun training, we were. But there was, I mean, the whole battalion was on the boat. And there were a lot of other people on the boat, sort of joining other units and other regiments, either in Singapore or Hong Kong or even Korea. So we had quite a few extra people on the
boat. So what exactly machine gun training? I mean, were you actually firing it off the boat? Or what?
No, we never fired it, not from the boat. But it was mainly stoppages and cleaning and putting the lock together, using the dial sight, just general MMG training.
And were you seasick?
No. No. fortunately, I don't know why, but as a kid, I couldn't travel 5 miles on a bus without throwing up. But I somehow thought, well, I've got a long while on the boat. I'm not going to be sick. And I think it was mind over matter. And because you're only out a couple of days and you're going around the Bay of Biscay, which was rough. And I wasn't sick. And I thought, well, I'm okay now, you know.
What about the rest of them?
There was some terrible seasickness, actually. I've got to say that, you know, after the boat reeked, really, you know, it was awful. And this was the sort of first wave of sickness, if you like, you know, people, they just threw up, you know, it was awful. But the only thing I liked about rough seas was that people who were sick didn't eat, and I could go around twice and get double rations, you know. The boat trip was quite pleasant. We had quite a bit of leisure time when you could sort of lie around or play cards or stuff like this, you know. And the card games used to be mostly sort of pontoons and stuff like this, you know. And
not gambling or not gambling?
Yes, gambling.
Did you gamble or have a go?
Lightly. Carefully. But going a bit further on, when we were in Korea, I was a number one, so I was...
We'll come back to that.
Yeah. So we had, I heard through the section that two of our lads on the section, one had got an IOU for £100 from the other guy through playing cards. It upset me a bit because I thought, well, you know, we're all in this together. And anyway,
I was taking it too far.
We didn't know what to do about it. But anyway, one night when the guy that owned the IOU was on guard, we went through his kit and found it and burnt it, you know. So, and nothing was ever said, so that got rid of that one. But, you know, going back to the card games, and this was the sort of silly thing that could happen.
Now, anything about the voyage, you know, any stops you made on it, what happened?
Well, we stopped, the first stop would be Port Said. We were allowed 2 or 3 hours shore leave.
And that'd be your first time abroad?
Oh, yes, yeah.
And what did you think of Port Said?
Well, I think it stank. In fact, you could smell it before you actually got there, you know. Dirty. And the impression was, it was definitely dirty, and everyone was trying to rob you. You know, that was the impression. Maybe not from as bad as that, but that, you know, as a young lad, you kept your hand in your pocket, you know, where your money was, sort of thing. And lots of cheap stuff you could sort of buy. Lots of people selling stuff from boats, you know, under our ship. We then sailed on to Aden, where the whole battalion, it was quite funny, did a route march. And there must have been, what, 1,000 in the battalion. Of that, I suppose, there were 900 plus marching. And there weren't many made it back because of the heat.
What's it like? How did you do?
I made it. Yeah, I actually made it back. But a lot didn't. They just flaked, you know, and had to be bought into 3-tonners and taken back to the boat. And I think it was a bit too far. I don't think we were ready for that, you know, at that stage. And I think it was a bit too much. I mean, the heat was oppressive. And
what state were you in at the end of it?
Well, again, I think, you know, you get so far and you know you're going to make it, and you sort of, you're on top of the world, you know. I was okay, you know.
And where next?
From Aden we went to Ceylon, and I think we had about four hours shore leave there.
What do you think of Ceylon?
It was sort of better than Aden, and obviously better than Port Said.
Was this in the big naval base, Trincomalee, or was it?
Well, I mean, we just
Colombo.
Yeah, Colombo. Yeah. We were allowed shore leave, I think 4 hours, and we found a hotel with a swimming pool and spent most of the time in the pool before going back to the boat. I remember that. And the next stop would then be Hong Kong, where we had, I think, 6 hours shore leave, and I'm guessing there a bit. And people did various things. I mean, a lot of us went to have a tattoo because it was the thing to do. And
did you have one?
Yes, I did, actually. Yeah, I had one on my arm. I don't know why now, but, you know. But at the time, it was, you know, old soldier stuff, you know. And then on from Hong Kong to Busan.
Now, what were your first impressions when you got to Busan?
I don't really know. We docked, and there was a great big American band playing St. Louis Blues March, you know, in the typical American way. We were all standing on the side of the boat cheering, sort of thing, what I remember of it. We knew it was going to be a bit unkind. That's the impression we got, you know. From there, we went into
what was Busan itself like?
Sorry?
What was Busan itself like?
Well, the dock was pretty rough, the dock area. And you've got to appreciate, we didn't get to look around Busan, only get onto lorries and go to a transit camp, where we must have stayed a few days. I can't really remember.
Is this the one they call Britannia camp, or is that another?
What was that name again?
Britannia.
Can't remember what the camp was called. You're probably right, but I can't remember.
And what were you doing in the transit camp?
Waiting to go up the front, really, basically. And we weren't there many days, I'm sure. Perhaps we finished getting kitted out. I don't really remember too much about that. And then we were taken to the station, and we actually got on a train and went as far as yes, we caught a train at Busan, and we went up as far as Seoul, sitting on wooden seats, which were very uncomfortable. I didn't have much to eat, and I don't know how long the journey lasted, but it seemed to last the best part of 2 days, chugging along at about 10 miles an hour.
And what do you make of the countryside as you went past, you know?
Well, all we seemed to see was sort of people heading south. carrying bundles, carrying children. Not really taking much notice of us, you know, they weren't very, obviously very happy. Lots of paddy and rice, lots of hills and mountains. I suppose that was a general impression. A lot of burnt out American vehicles and stuff like that that you see, and, you know, signs of war. But, no, that was about it. And then...
Now, had you been assigned to a section by this time, you know, on the boat, or when did that happen?
Had what?
Been assigned as number one or number two. I mean, had they made up the machine gun teams?
They'd made them all up. And,
Have that been done on the boat?
More or less, yes. But when I got to Korea, and you appreciate, I did the range takers course, so I was perhaps a little bit behind. But I believe I sort of began to shine on the boat training, and as soon as we got to Korea, I was made up to a Lance Corporal number one. So they then got all the number ones. One chap that was a number one, he wasn't satisfactory, so they took his stripe away.
Now, what difference did it make being promoted to Lance Corporal? I mean, that's quite good.
Yeah. Oh, dear, yeah, you know, not been in the army in less than a year, and I'm a Lance Corporal. That was the feeling you got, you know. Pleased. And I think I was pleased because... where I lived was a village, and all the local lads that had ever been in the forces had never got a stripe, you know. So I suppose I felt a bit one-upmanship in a way.
Did it change the way you dealt with it, people who were still privates? I mean, did you have to maintain any level of separation?
Well, you had to be the boss of your gun and the crew, and you had to take your share of responsibility in the section. But you've got to remember, we were all in this together. We'd all trained together. So there was a certain amount of, I suppose, laxity in a way. I mean, it wasn't hard discipline stuff out there, you know. You'd all got a job to do, and providing they did the job, there was no need to sort of put too much pressure on.
Now, well, would they still call you Nick? Nick,
oh, yes,
Nicole?
It was, I mean, yeah. That, yeah, was, it was always Nick, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, would they'd still call you that? They wouldn't, yeah, call you Corporal, could Lance Corporal?
Only if there was an officer around, but no, it was Nick, you know.
And what would you call them, the first name or...
Yeah, my number two was Clark, who's called him Nobby, you know, yeah.
And who was on your gun crew? I mean, let's go... if you remember them. Who,
yes,
was,
I was number one, obviously. Nobby Clark, or Basil Clark, Buzz Clark, they used to call him, was number two.
And he was a private?
Private, yeah. From the number one corporal there, the rest were private. And the number three, well, as I say, they were sort of odd buds in a way, in that your number three... could be any one of the spare people in the section. The one and two were the main.
So what was ones. What was Basil Clark like then, as a bloke?
Country boy, solid, you know, reliable, quite talented in lots of ways, very reliable. If anything had happened to me, he'd have taken the gun over and there'd have been no problems, you know, he was good.
And you got on well with him?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you lived underground and you lived together and you did your job together. You had to get on, really. But fortunately, we did get on well.
Now, where did you go then? You went to Seoul, and where from Seoul?
Well, we then started to go north to a sort of a reserve area where the battalion reformed, if you like.
Now that probably is Britannia Camp, but
I can't remember.
Was it the Pikehurst Reservoir area?
No, we
you're not sure?
No, we went back to the reservoir area while we were in reserve, but I don't remember going there, going up.
So what were you doing in this reserve area?
Oh, well, we only went back to the reserve area to...
No, sorry, I mean this area on the way up.
Well, again, just waiting to go up, you know. And... you see, we left England in September. It took roughly 6 weeks. And by the time we got up to the front line, it was October. Right. And then we actually took up a sort of a front line position in the October. And as I say, we were attached to C Company, another section to A Company, and another section to B Company or D Company. I'm not sure about
now,
that.
Now, was this the Coxsackie area you were going into? That's
the where?
The Coxsackie. Oh, it's where the mountains are.
Yeah. Yes, we could see 355, as we all called it, from our position.
And where was it? Did the feature C Company were on have a name?
No. Most of the hills we just called by number.
And you don't know
that? I can't remember the number of that hill, no.
They can look that up again.
But I mean, I always remember 355 because there were so many battles over 355.
And that was nearby?
Oh, yes, we could see it quite well here, quite now, easily.
Can you give us an idea of what the just in this area you moved into, what the terrain was like? The sort of
We were on a small, a fairly low hill. I'm talking about my section now. In a valley. Down the valley to the left was 355. And to the right of that was what we call Bunker Hill. And then beyond that, 316 and a ridge where the KOSB regiment was. Right. And I suppose, in a way, we were front line, but it was a fairly way back front line on the bit we were in.
Now, what was the actual ground like? I mean, it's very difficult to describe ground, but I mean, and the sort of vegetation.
Well, there was lots of fir trees that had been cut in half, usually by shell and shrapnel, I presume. Some of them had charred from fire and whatnot. Lots of sort of brush. In the valley, there were disused paddy fields, a stream, some trees. General sort of scrubby type vegetation, but it was all right.
Now, what sort of positions were C Company in? Can you describe these first? Well, I don't know whether they're trenches, but positions.
Well, the position we were in, we looked down this valley, right overlooking the centre of the valley. C Company were behind us to the left. A Company were further forward than us, and I can't just remember where the other companies were. And it was our first taste at, well, building a proper gun pit.
Was a gun pit? How would you build a machine gun pit, or were you taking one over?
We have taken them over, but mostly we built our own.
And what were they like?
First of all, you were given a position and you dug a reasonably deep hole. The roof was usually consisted of what you could find, which was, if you were lucky, with tree trunks. Usually if you could scrounge a tarpaulin of some sort to go over them to keep the wet out, and then soil and rock on top of that, bearing in mind you had heavy rains, and if you had too much weight in the roof, your roof might, collapse. So it was sort of a balance between that. You sometimes lined the pit, we called it a gun pit, with sandbags full of sand. And then you had an aperture at the front of the pit for your field of fire.
How big?
Yeah.
How deep?
I guess in about 4 feet. Yeah, about 4 feet.
How deep?
And that would be the depth of the wall of your gun pit.
And from top to bottom?
Oh, well then...
6 inches?
You could stand in the gun pit. You could
stand. The slit.
Yeah, and I was going to say, if you stood in the gun pit, you then built a platform up to about between knee and hip height, which your gun tripod stood on, and then your gun on top of that. So your gun, end of your gun barrel, was about centre of the 4 feet, if you know what I mean. So it'd be perhaps 18 inches from the top and 18 inches from the bottom and 2 feet either side. Now, that's a bit of a guess, but that's what I would say, you know. And set back, you got a lot of noise, but you also, it helped with the flash, you know, if you flash them or not.